Welcome to the Spirituality of Strength Training with your host, Anna Willard. This podcast is dedicated to bring you knowledge, wisdom, inspiration, and guidance to wherever you may be on your health journey. For those who are new to me, I am a kettlebell strength coach, a movement nerd ninja, and an empowerment coach on a mission to bring you hope through our health. The root word of health comes from wholeness. The root word of wholeness comes from holy. Despite our differences with religion and spiritual beliefs, we are all human beings with a body that is designed to reflect this holiness through our health. It wasn't until my 7th year as a health profession where I went into a deep awakening of understanding what does it mean to train my spirit and to heal my spirit through the physical. You'll hear a little bit more about my story from other health professionals, from strength coaches, psychiatrists, spiritual gurus and leaders, to other people who talk about the importance of our health as a community body and the health of our planet as well. This podcast is to allow us to step into our whole health, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Thank you for being here. If you love what you hear, I encourage you to subscribe. If you want more inspiration and quotes from these podcasts, I encourage you to follow me on Instagram at @Anna_Willard_. I encourage you to do a little bit of a movement, either a yoga flow, go for a walk, sit in nature, as you enjoy this episode. Hey, Strong Ones, we have an incredible guest on the show today. It is Brett Jones, who is the chief instructor at Strong First. Brett, welcome to the show.
Anna, it's great to be on with you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you and your audience.
Yeah, I'm really excited that you had the opportunity to do this, and I'm really excited to learn from you as we dive into the conversation. Can you just tell the listeners exactly what your role is within the Strong First community?
Sure. I'm currently Director of Education for Strong First, so I manage the curriculum for all of our one-day courses, our certifications, our leadership and those individuals who are responsible for teaching those various one-day courses and certifications.
Awesome. Cool. That's a lot.
It is. Yes. it has become kind of more and more as the years have gone by. I've been very fortunate. I've been traveling and teaching with Pavel for the last 16 years. So it's been the Grateful Dead had it right. What a long, strange trip it's been. So
cool. Now, how did you get involved with kettlebells? Like, what was that introductory story that you have, and why did you stay with kettlebells over all types of exercise?
So I had been recommended one of Pavel's original books, Power to the People. I started looking at it, reading it, started deadlifting and doing the routine, and certainly became very interested in what Pavel had to say. And this would have been 2000. And the marketing machine kicked in. I started hearing about kettlebells and got the book, got the original RKC book, Russian Kettlebell Challenge, and then eventually got my first kettlebell in late 01, went and got certified in February of 02, and started teaching with Pavel in April of 03.
Wow. That's cool. So I haven't turned back.
No, it's been, I cannot imagine my career or kind of fitness life and everything without Pavel and kettlebells and Gray Cook at FMS and, you know, everything that's kind of come about as a result.
Awesome. Cool. When we first met, it was actually at an FMS certification. I don't know if you remember this. It was in Seattle and it was 2013. And I was like in the prime of my ski season. And I think I drew out on the back of FMS the course for you. I was like, this is what I do. And I was super excited to learn all this like corrective exercises because as a skier, I was always injured. And I remember go ahead.
No, no, I was just saying, right? Yep.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so I asked you, I was like, I don't know exactly what I asked you, but I asked you of like, do I keep focusing on my sport or do I really kind of change gears and focus on my career? And my question comes from a lot of us who are trainers have always had a love obsession with some type of sport. And that's how we got involved with becoming a coach or a trainer. What advice do you have for those who still want to pursue a sport while still managing their career as a fitness coach?
It's certainly challenging. The number of hours needed to dedicate towards an activity that you really want to achieve a high skill in, that can be a quote full-time job. It can be quite demanding. I like to think that a fitness lifestyle lends itself towards being able to take on various activities, whatever those may be, whether it's competitive skiing, dancing, whatever the case may be. We obviously lean a little more in the strength oriented direction, so it could be powerlifting or gear voice sport, kettlebell sport. There's a variety of things. At a certain point, just all comes about time management and work-life balance and how much time you can dedicate towards something like a sport, for lack of a better term, career, and versus your work career versus your family,
right,
et cetera. There's certainly multiple aspects there. And everybody's got to kind of make those calculations as what they feel like they can do. Some like triathletes and training for triathlons can be quite time consuming. There's going to be X number of hours a week where you're trying to get in the pool or get in the water for your to get your mileage. There's going to be time on the bike. There's time running and things of that nature. So really just kind of have to sit down and almost kind of chart it out and see where you want to put your emphasis and how much time you want to dedicate towards that thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned work-life balance. As a, people who are in this field, we're very passionate about exercise. And I know I've had a couple conversations with other coaches of how like sometimes our workouts feel like it's a job almost, and how it kind of bleeds into like the fun almost is taking out of it because of the fact like we're constantly at the same location of our work and our workouts. How do we balance the fun aspect and the joy of moving again within our career where it is evolved around movement and exercise?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great challenge because I've worked at a variety of different locations, 25 plus years of working in fitness, athletic training and things of that nature. This will sound sad, but it's not.
Okay.
I've basically trained on my own by myself for like the last about 18 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
So I created recognizing that if I worked out at the facility where I was managing training, doing whatever, if I worked out at that facility at certain times, I wasn't going to get my workout in. I was going to get questions. I was going to be working still, trying to help people because they just, you're there, you work there.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, like if you've already been there for 10 hours, spending an extra hour there getting your own training in, it becomes very, very difficult. So I've trained at home with kettlebells, primarily over the last, significant period of time. When I was doing a lot of kettlebell training, I actually enjoyed doing my own training via the barbell and, you know, creating a little bit of separation there that I was doing something different for myself and switching gyms or locations. One of my, you know, predominantly right now over the last few years, I travel and teach. 4 or so years ago, I gave up basically a full-time job of managing and training at a club in Pittsburgh. And that's separation between what I do for myself and what I do for clients and people that I may train online. See a limited number of people here in Pittsburgh, but you know, it's definitely I recommend creating that separation. And that gets challenging as well, because if you're known in an area and you go into somebody else's gym, that can be a challenging situation. But like I said, I've kind of trained almost predominantly at home, outside of powerlifting, barbell training, which, you know, I moved back to Pittsburgh. I had started in California 04, 05. Moved back to Pittsburgh 06, late 06. And by 2008, I had kind of, I had a couple things happening and wasn't really going barbell training much anymore. And so I kind of segued predominantly back into the kettlebells, bodyweight training again. And, but it's definitely creating some separation. If you are teaching a lot of kettlebell classes, you may enjoy of your own training being more bodyweight based or barbell based and, you know, things of that nature. I have a friend of mine that I work with, and he enjoys hopping in a cycling class and just kind of shutting off his own thoughts and just kind of getting into the class and the music and letting the instructor guide the ride. And that I'm fully in support of that.
Right.
Because it's just that opportunity to switch off and be guided, and it works out really well.
Yeah. There was a time last week where I was like, I just need a break. And I drove up all the way up to Mount Vernon, and that's about like an hour drive. And I was like, just get me to a gym where I don't know anyone and no one knows me and no one talks to me, so I can just focus on my workout.
Definitely.
And yeah, it was like a break where I was like, I just need that mental break.
Without a doubt, because you know, typically we get into fields like this because we're caring individuals, and we can lean in the direction of being caretakers, and we take on a responsibility with the people who ask us for advice or that we're working with, and so we need time to not be responsible for others and time to just take care of ourselves and recharge our own batteries for, I know that's the popular kind of term for it. So, but yeah, it's definitely those times where you can unplug, get away from everything. And, that's why I don't think me training by myself for the last X number of years, 18 plus years, has necessarily been a bad thing, because I've been able to just those that I have had my time to not be responsible for other people and to do my own thing.
With training by yourself, do you find yourself a lot more in tuned to your own body? Because, and I ask this because it's been like the last two, almost 3 years that I've been really drawn to, like, let me have my own place and not work out with people, but I need to have my space to really listen to my body. And I think it's because of like all the injuries that I've dealt with, and I've like really being in tune and honoring my space with that versus like trying to keep up with other people or try to keep up on pace with the class. What have you gained from working out by yourself on a like intuitive level with your body?
Well, it's all of the above that you just kind of mentioned. There's not the competitive aspect. Like I'm not concerned with if I don't pick up the biggest kettlebell I have because somebody else just did something with it. Like I don't get worried about having to meet those kind of challenges on an ongoing basis when I'm around other people that are training. I really, music is a background thing. I don't focus on it, and it's in the background, and it's usually something fairly chill, mm-hmm. Or just kind of fun. Like, I love listening to Talking Heads when I work out and stuff like that. So it's just something that's kind of fun, and you know, singing along to Psycho Killer in between sets of swings is just kind of a nice way to relax. But the mindfulness that I'm able to bring to my practice is certainly enhanced by the idea that I have an opportunity just to focus on every rep and to learn from every rep. I think it's been a benefit. And even when I was powerlifting, you can squat and deadlift on your own, mm-hmm. In the power rack with the safeties properly set. You can squat on your own. Deadlift, of course, needs no spotters. Bench, I'd have to get somebody to give me a lift off or something like that. But even then, I was able to just kind of focus on my training and be mindful of what I was doing in my practice. I think that's something that now, to my friend's point about hopping in a cycling class,
right,
and just kind of shutting off, listen to the music, and let the instructor guide the ride, like that's great. Like, I've actually done a good number of spinning classes and yoga classes myself, and it's really great to have those opportunities to just not have to worry about my own program design and just know mm-hmm. that for the next whatever half hour, 45 minutes, hour, I can just go along. And so kind of a mix there, but I really have enjoyed all of my exercise time because of the mindfulness and the focus that I can kind of bring with it.
Now, going off of that, I know we kind of talked when we were together in Denver about the power of a group of people working out together and that energy of being in that same pace and that same rhythm, everything down to the detail of our breath. And I think that's what makes the level one certification such a memorable moment for so many people. I know that was for me. Can you talk a little bit more about the power of people coming together and moving in synchronicity with one another?
Certainly. It's why group exercise has been a dominant aspect of the fitness world for, I don't know, 30 plus years.
Yeah.
Going back to the step aerobic days and, you know, things of that nature, where people just loved getting in a class, having this instructor up there with this great personality who was going to guide them and bring them along, maybe bring things out of them that they didn't think that they could do, and, you know, things of that nature. And, you know, you got the music, and then you get the social reinforcement, you know, oh, why didn't you make class last week? You know, people are kind of looking out for you. And so group exercise in general is a huge motivator. And when we do a level one, I'm fresh off the level one we just did in Atlanta. So I'm not only tired, but, you know, kind of excited coming off of our level one. And same thing. We bark. We get people counting in rhythm with their swings, and get people clapping and cheering and things like that. And really, it's a social aspect that we're probably disconnected from. The more we get connected, the less we are connected. And it's why group exercise continues to be what it is in the fitness field, as we crave those opportunities to connect and to be, to your point, part of that team for that moment.
Yeah. And I think that's why what drew me, or what was like so addicting almost for the Strong First, when I got my first certification, it was back in 2013, and there was a lot of stress going on in my life, and it was such a great weekend for me because I was up in Canada, so I had no cell service, and I was able to completely disconnect so I could like reconnect with my body, but also at the same time reconnect with a group of people that I had no idea who these people were, but there was just like that underlying current that movement brought within the group, which was so magical. With that said, I know a lot of people, including myself, after they've experienced their first level one, they are like so eager to get to other certifications. And there's no other certification like the level one, in my experience, just because that's your first one. What advice do you have for those who either just did their level one or have that hunger for something like that again, and how to manage that hunger for that type of connection through movement?
It really, the way we do the level one, and you know, I asked the question yesterday when we had finished the grad practice session, and mm-hmm. everybody's sweaty and, you know, yeah. just in that moment, and, you know, just asked a very simple question. Do you feel different than when you came on Friday morning? Mm-hmm. And resounding yes from everybody. And so going through having a kind of a shared mission of accomplishing this certification, which does have a good amount of physical challenge to it, mm-hmm. Not just the hundreds of reps of practice of all the drills, and really kind of emptying your cup and humbling yourself to accept the instruction, even though you may come in very prepared. You know that you're there to be made better and to take on the education and techniques. So there's all of that going on. There's six different practice sessions. There's the grad session. There's the snatch test. Mm-hmm. So there's a big physical challenge, and something in our lives, kind of on an ongoing basis, we have very few rites of passage as a society anymore. And so this becomes kind of a rite of passage that you've made it through this thing. And you have an idea, not always a guarantee, but you have an idea that when you run into a fellow SFG and Strong First instructor, you know that they've made that rite of passage. And so there's this automatic, you know, it's like I saw a post the other day that the Jeep wave has disappeared. Like Jeep owners, like you, they would, wave to each other, and it was kind of this little secret club. You were part of the Jeep community, and so we have that within what we do. And you're right; it is the post SFG weekend depression is a real thing. Like people leave and they go home, and they're like, but it's a very real thing, and so they do want to come back and they want to go through more. That's why we have people give time. We have assistants come in who give up time with family, friends, and business and invest their own money to travel and be there and get their research taken care of. But they want to reconnect with that feeling of having been a part of that group. You do have to, I feel like, you have to have a little delay of self-gratification, and you have to draw that out a little bit. Keep kind of drawing that, you have a 2-year certification window. You don't have to go to level two 6 months later and try to knock that out. You can, and level two is different, where level one has a big physical challenge. I think level two has a little bit more mental challenge, and skill challenge that's involved. SFLs, I myself put in 12 plus weeks of prep to get ready for SFL. Put in, you know, a few weeks prep to get ready for SFB, had kind of interesting experiences at both of those as a student. I went through as a student, passed the standards, put myself, in those shoes and did that. But you know, none of them have the, that rite of passage aspect of SFG. So it is a challenge. It's something that's hard to replicate. Hopefully within the community that people work and live within where they are, they have friends and people that can keep them on that kind of aspect. So
yeah. With okay, this happens to me all the time. The question came and now it escaped my mind. this is it. As a coach, a lot of times you can only take your clients so far that you have gone physically. Do you agree with that or disagree with that? Because I think of coaches who train Olympians. There's no way they can physically possibly get them or to them themselves do what they're teaching or coaching their athlete. So where comes that line of like, as a coach, of like, I can get you to this place even though I can't do that? And where as a coach do we need to be like, okay, I can get you there. I need to train this myself first and then I can get you there. Is that more of a personal knowledge awareness type of thing as a coach, or how do you respond to that?
Well, I'm going to go a couple different directions.
Okay, great.
Because the best kicking coach in the NFL, and I believe he currently still is, or was up until recently, this is a gentleman that's been wheelchair bound his entire life. He has never kicked a football. Mm-hmm. And yet his passion for it led him to study film and the science of kicking to the point that he is the best kicking coach in the NFL.
That's awesome.
And so there's that argument that you can't train me if you haven't done exactly what I've done. I really don't fully believe in that. I think that there's an easier connection to the person you're trying to train if you understand what they're passionate about.
Right.
And there's certain cues that you're going to be able to bring to bear. Friends of mine who end up training mixed martial artists and people that are into Brazilian jiu-jitsu, they end up training Brazilian jiu-jitsu themselves because it gives them a better appreciation for what that client, student, athlete, you know, whomever they're working with, gives them a better appreciation for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And then you can speak the same language, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I think more than anything, understand doing, at least giving them the opportunity to show you what they're doing, explain the language, the coaching, the cueing that they're doing within this other thing that they want to be better at. I think that's always a smart thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, coaches, trainers, instructors, especially in today's social media driven world with Instagram, and, you know, Business Insider had an article, it was a couple of years ago now, but it was the top 10 fitness influencers. I only recognized one of the names out of the 10. And I've been part of this industry for quite some time. And all of them were like million and 3 million followers on Instagram, which is how they got the title of influencer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was all based on physical appearance. It was the guy working out without a shirt on. It was a female working out in, you know, bra top and shorts and whatnot. And so it was the fitness knowledge potentially was mm-hmm. very low in those situations, but there was certainly a physical appeal that drew people to follow these people. And then in social media terms, once you crack, you know, 1 million, 2 million followers, you're an influencer. And the best people in the world are typically busy training people 10 or 12 hours a day for mm-hmm. 5-6 days a week. And they're not posting pictures of themselves on social media. So that thing, you know, do you look the part sort of thing. Now I enjoy my training, but I also enjoy food. And certainly you're not going to see any shirtless pics coming from me ever anytime. And so so there's this aspect that people are looking, I don't know. There's also this aspect of fitness now that we're supposed to be, or people try to be, aspirational. They want to put out this image and they want to put out this message that is aspirational. If you work out hard, you could be this as well. Mm. Most of those kind of, I'm not a fan of, of those sorts of messages, because it's usually there's an aspect of shaming that's underneath that message, that I'm trying to be aspirational, but don't you feel bad about not doing this because now you can't be what I think you should be. And I say all the time to trainers and people at workshops, meet your student where they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Meet them where they are. You'll mm-hmm. be surprised where you can take them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very old saying that nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah.
And so that kind of is more my bend on it. So I think you should understand what the person is trying to accomplish, but I do not think you necessarily have to have walked in those elite level shoes.
Right. Yeah. You bring up a really good, an important topic about body shame. And the readers, or not readers, the listeners know that I was in grad school for a short period of time. And during that time, that's when I really was like, had a look in the mirror of the fact of like, I carry a lot of body shame. And people who've seen my physique, they're like, Anna has like a beautiful body. Why does she have body shame? And it comes from my story of being adopted and not knowing my biological father and getting a lot of genetics from him, and knowing that just from what my mom has told me that he was very built muscular, and I'm getting that from him, gave me a lot of shame because that's something that's not from my family. And so working through that has been such a challenge. What advice do you have for people within the fitness industry? And it doesn't even have to be the fitness industry, but what advice do you have for people who exercise and the balance of between exercise and the love for your body versus the body shame that goes into it that our society has put on within this industry?
Well, it's I mean, speaking of the $64,000 questions and yeah. You know, the really important things, there's out of the millions of memes that are out there, the one that I do like is that, you know, exercise is a celebration of what your body can do, not mm-hmm. a punishment for what you ate or, you know, things of that nature. Like we should even go back to Socrates that, you know, it's a shame for an individual to not to live their life and not know what their body is capable of physically. Mm-hmm. And we're all going to go in different directions. There's people out there that are definitely better suited towards running and cardiovascular activities, or there's people that are more suited towards strength activities. I certainly lean in that direction myself. You know, celebrating what we can do, mm-hmm. and appreciating what we have this, and I refer to it at workshops as this incredible meat suitcase that holds this incredible bowl of gelatin that has more neural connections in your brain than there are particles in the universe. And there's this amazing aspect to what we are. And mm-hmm. We diminish that and take away from that by imposing, you know, a physical standard. You know, being healthy, eating well, being healthy, sleeping well, you know, just kind of being healthy and taking care of yourself, celebrating what this thing that we get to drive around the universe is capable of. I think that's it's a more positive message. And we, within Strong First, we simply encapsulate that into strength has a greater purpose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if someone has a physique goal that they would like to accomplish, cool. Mm-hmm. I will refer you to someone else. I actually don't do physique based, programming. Mm-hmm. It doesn't interest me. I'm not, excited by it. It's not something that I, want to accomplish, want to feel better, want to get stronger, want to celebrate what your body can do. I'm in, for that. And we can move forward on that. Unfortunately, we are now, it's always been an uphill battle. Now it is a particularly uphill battle with social media mm-hmm. and, people putting out these, you know, idealized images of themselves and their lives and not really being open and honest about the struggles. And, I remember a very famous fitness person who, swore somewhat secrecy because he was getting ready to take a bite of like a cheesecake or something because his followers could not know that he kind of cheated on his diet and had had a bite of something that might actually taste good. And so I think, you know, just as an industry, I think there's a difference between gathering followers and being trying to get to that influencer aspirational aspect. And you know, it's, and I think the bitter pill for some of us is, it's not about us. Mm-hmm. It is about the person that we're working with
yeah.
and what would they like to accomplish.
And that's where my next question goes. As coaches, how can we be more cognitively aware of some of the body shame that our clients may be carrying within their own workouts? And how do we create a place for them to almost let go of that in a way that we don't even necessarily have to like speak about it, if you understand what I mean by that?
Sure, absolutely. No, and I think that it's going to sound overly simplistic, but I think when we shift the training to accomplishing strength in whatever form that takes, I'm not saying it's a max deadlift or anything like that. I'm just saying when we shift the goal from I'm doing this exercise to look a certain way to I'm trying to gain skill in this exercise, I'm trying to gain strength in this pattern, this exercise, this thing that I want to be better at, there's almost a natural shifting away from, because as students begin to accomplish these things, regardless of what they look like, we've now shifted that message from we're doing this exercise so your arms look good at the beach, to we've accomplished your first pull-up.
Yeah.
And so that journey and that shift of focus is something that when you bring a focus towards strength and an accomplishment of a skill, a goal, something that is completely unrelated, you don't ever have to have the conversation about what your body looks like because it doesn't matter what your body looks like. Mm-hmm. It matters that you accomplished this goal, this skill, this thing.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to share a little bit more about my Iron Maiden experience. And it goes along with this type of coaching that we're talking about. So I attempted my first Iron Maiden in Philly. And I was really looking forward to the certification, thinking it would have the same type of environment as the level one. Again, there was a lot of stress going on in my life at that time. And I was really looking forward to connecting with a group of people in a way that didn't have to speak in like a grad workout type of thing. And level two doesn't necessarily have a grad workout where we're all doing the same things. It's working out on different. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. We added one.
Oh, you did? Oh.
Yeah.
Dang it.
Sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but it was like, oh, no, we added one.
Well, this was back in fall of 2017, so.
Correct. Correct. So we have added one. So
oh, great. Good.
I apologize I truly apologize for interrupting. Please.
No, that's please, okay. Please continue. So anyway, so I did the Iron Maiden, or attempted the Iron Maiden, didn't get it, super frustrated. Went back to the gym and just trained super hard. Look at all the other certifications that were within that year, because I was really focused on getting it, my Iron Maiden that year. And I saw the Denver certification that you're hosting, and I was like, or that you're teaching, I was like, that's it. Like, I'm going to that one. That's where I'm going to get it. Denver has always been like some type of home for me, just because my grandparents are there. I've competed really well in Denver for some reason. So when the time came for me to warm up with the Iron Maiden, I think the biggest thing for me was the small interaction that you gave me. I don't even know if you remember this at all, but I was warming up and there was another person who was attempting her Iron Maiden as well. And it looked like she had her coach, and I wasn't sure if it was a significant other or not, but that's where my mind went. I was like, oh, that would be really nice to have, you know, someone who cares to be there for these big events. And I just kept warming up, and you came over and you mentioned something of like, make sure you do this with your pull-up. I was like, oh, dude, I got this. Like, pull-ups are my jam. Like, don't worry. Like, and just that little interaction was just like that little boost of confidence that I needed to know that I had this, like, I got it. And I had that going in, but I just needed that little extra. Now, my question goes into, as coaches, I know sometimes we can almost mother our clients too much of like, well, this is how you need to do this. This is what you need to do this. And almost like tell them too much versus actually giving them the confidence that they need. So I share that story because that's what you gave me, and other past experience, I've been overcoached and it was too much and I couldn't get into my body and I second guessed my ability. As coaches, how do we help our clients own their own confidence and give that gift to them?
Definitely. It's a line to walk, and the line to walk is and this is for me personally, I stay away from the always encouraging message. And let me explain that.
Okay. Yeah.
Because there may be something that I need to tell you, you need to improve. So I can't say that was just amazing, but you need to do this, because that difference in that message is very, it's contradictory. It's confusing. Mm-hmm. You told me it was awesome, but now I know I need to do this. So it wasn't really awesome. And now I don't know where to go. And now the second guessing gets in, because what the next time I say, hey, that was really awesome, what's the background thought? The background thought is, yeah, you're just saying that. Mm. And I get that from a lot of students who are, you know, I'll be like, that was great. And they're like, well, yeah, you're just saying that. Well, I've established early on that if I think there's something that needs to be improved, you're going to hear that.
Yeah.
And I will say, hey, look, you're putting in great effort. You are doing a great job. To really take this to the next level, we need to work on X. Mm. Now, in the process of giving you a drill or something to build that thing that I think we need to work, I will encourage you when the right thing happens. So you might be 5 reps in before I'm like, yeah, that's it. I'm not going to start telling you, yeah, that's it from the first rep if it's not there. Mm-hmm. So I kind of develop a more honest with the student, rather than wanting to always be the encourager and motivator. And some of my students who may end up listening to this will recognize I am not the motivator. I will assist and coach and guide and do those things. But I think your internal locus of control and your internal motivation is what needs to be dominant. Mm-hmm. So I think an honest rapport is the key to this kind of more positive, in the end, what is a more positive coaching relationship, because there's never that background thought of, oh, well, you're just saying that. Mm-hmm. You know, but yet you have to stay away from the it's never good enough style of coaching either.
Right. Yeah.
Where, oh yeah, you know, good set, but boy, if we could just change this, this, and this, it'd be really good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot. So now it's never good enough, you know.
Right.
So there's this dichotomy of coaching where you're either always encouraging, yet knowing something needs to change, therefore mm-hmm. there's the second guessing, or there's this constant never good enough mm-hmm. Aspect of coaching. And neither of those things end up well in my experience.
Yeah.
Now, there's people who they're already second guessing themselves anyway, so mm-hmm. they'll gravitate towards the always encouraging, but I know there's something I need to fix style of coaching because mm-hmm. it just fits with what they have going on. There's people who don't think anything's ever good enough anyway, so they'll gravitate towards the coach for whom nothing's ever good enough. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, I just think there's this middle ground that, I have these conversations with people all the time that, and this is validated via research on learning, both mm-hmm. physical and mental, and something that we have to embrace in our own lives is that struggle is the key. Mm-hmm. Getting things wrong. There's an old joke that good judgment, that wisdom is just good judgment, and good judgment comes from bad judgment. So we have to make mistakes. And we just have to accept that that is part of life, and that in building skill, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to get things wrong, and it's fine. It's all just part of the process. There was a meme, this 92-year-old, and his name just went right out of my head because I not a musician, and this is a famous like cellist, who at 92 years old was asked, why are you still practicing? And the response was, I think I'm starting to make progress. Like, I think I might finally be starting to get this. This is after a lifetime and a career as a high level musician.
Yeah.
I'm still practicing because I think I might start, I think I'm starting to make some progress. And so embracing this idea that struggle is good. Struggle is, and maybe it's a little more stoic philosophy than it is a lot of others. And however you want to frame it, and it doesn't matter how you frame it. We all need to struggle. Now, if we go in the all struggle category and we just think life should, pardon my language, just kind of suck, that's not a great place to be. But if we think life is all champagne and roses, that's not a great place to be either, because you will be let down, in that situation. So I think that, you know, the honest rapport, the idea that, I'm going to tell you what you need to improve, but I'm also going to reinforce when it's done well, and the fact that your effort and your embracing of the struggle of the process is so much more important than how that rep looked. Or I did not meet one of my goals last year. Wrote an article about this for Strong First. I was going to accomplish Sinister last year, and it did not happen. And I am still training for it. And that is fine. Like I had put myself out there last year as that being a goal, and, there's nothing, well, the 15 people that read the article, you know, the, you put yourself out there for it. And, you know, you, I didn't get it done. So didn't feel bad about it. Simply said, this isn't going to happen right now. And, it's now the 2019 goal. That's the way it is. Embrace the process, embrace the struggle, appreciate learning every time I put my hand on a bell. And, so I think it's, there's, I'm sorry. That was kind of a wide ranging.
No, that's great. No, that was really good. Cause it made me realize of like, oh, this is how I coach, of like over motivating. And I give them like, okay, let's work on this one thing. And making, realizing like that comes from my perfectionism too.
And that's so one of the most important things as a coach and as a leader, period.
Yeah.
Is imposing your expectations on others.
Yeah. I'm learning that one.
It's a, and we do it. We have an entire list of unspoken, unwritten expectations. That we are bringing to all interactions. it doesn't matter if it's the barista at Starbucks or if it's the significant other or it's the person we're coaching. Like, we have these unwritten expectations that we are judging these interactions and relationships with. And you know, and something that will resonate is that, you know, everyone's going through a struggle that you know nothing about. And I had a friend of mine who, you know, he referenced recently that he would hold doors open for people. And when he wouldn't get a thank you, he would get mad. Like, why, you know, I just held the door for you. Why, where's my thank you? And a friend of his informed him that, A, it's not about you. And you're, if you're opening that door in order to get the thank you, you're opening the door for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
You're opening the door because you want to open it for that other person. And you don't know if, what's going on in their lives. And this goes back to Stephen Covey's Seven Habits, where he tells the story of being on the subway and this guy gets on with his three kids. And they're just maniacs. They're just all over causing all kinds of havoc. And Stephen Covey kind of leans over this guy and goes, hey, why don't you kind of control your kids there? He goes, yeah, you're right. Just came from the hospital. Their mom just died. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Covey's head explodes with this shame that he just came after this guy who's in this struggle. And that could be the person you meet tomorrow.
So what advice, I'm asking this more selfishly, what advice do you have for coaches who may find themselves being in that overmotivated, like, here's the one thing to work on, move into more of that neutral place of coaching. And we'll ask that as well for the other person who's like overcritical of not enough. Like, what advice do you have for coaches to move into that middle ground? And with that, my mind's thinking, how much personal work is involved with that?
It's in both cases, it's letting go a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's letting go. It's embracing the struggle, mm-hmm. and coaching someone to their goal is a process, mm-hmm. and there will be struggle involved. And it's letting go of that and kind of reconnecting with that person. Because on both ends of that spectrum, if you've been imposing those expectations on them, pulling them aside and saying, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
Like, just kind of, what do you want to do? You know, we've been working on this thing for a while. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do? You want to do something different? Like, is there something else going on that you want to work on? Like, just flip the conversation back, give it back to them. Mm. Put yourself back in the position of being the guide, mm-hmm. and not the director. Mm. And give them the chance to make a choice there.
Mm-hmm. Now, kind of flipping back to versus me as a coach versus the fact of like what training has given me with the kettlebell. I know there's been mm-hmm. a lot of personal and mental and emotional growth within myself with training with the kettlebell. What has training with the kettlebell given you, not just the physical aspect? I know you mentioned a little bit more on the mindfulness, but what mm-hmm. has kettlebell given you? And I know you mentioned earlier about an injury that you had to struggle through. But since we're talking about the struggle aspect, can you shine a little bit more light and share that?
Oh, sure. So I'm not a garage kept single owner that was only driven to church. I have been used well and have mileage. And some of that mileage is completely not my anything that I chose. I'll give you some details on that here in just a minute. I've had like 8 different surgeries, and some melanoma, and pulmonary embolism, and you know, I've had some things that could have had me not being available for this podcast. Mm-hmm. So you go through a couple of those things, and you start realizing that some of the stuff you think is important is not really quite so important. I had a septoplasty, had my nose broken a bunch of times in high school with wrestling and some other things. So I ended up having septoplasty once I was done participating in activities where breaking your nose was more of a risk. I had it reconstructed. I had a left knee arthroscopy, a left inguinal hernia repair, L5-S1 laminectomy. Back in 2003, I've had my appendix out. That led to a little ventral hernia, little size of a ping pong ball. Had that repaired, big piece of mesh put in. That led to the pulmonary embolism. Found out about the melanoma, had that excised, and had a central node biopsy to be sure it hadn't spread. So I've had a bunch of different things, and what I've always been able to go back to rehab myself, to get myself back where I want to be, is the kettlebell. Kettlebell training and the principles, the techniques, the things that we do, I've always been able to return to that. And, you know, post back surgery, went on to powerlifting and accomplished a few things that were decent. Mm-hmm. Nothing world record level or anything like that, but mm-hmm. good lifts. And so there's a confidence that comes from this idea that regardless of what I end up, what ends up happening, I think I have this tool and these principles and these things that will allow me to regain what I want to regain physically. Mm-hmm. And so that's, there's a good confidence that comes from that. that I know that when things happen, and they will, mm-hmm. That I have these things that I can rehab, regain, whatever you want to, whatever tag you want to put on it. So I think it's, I would wrap it all around this idea that I'm pretty confident. I'm confident that life will happen, that things will come about, and I'm confident that I have the tools and abilities and stubbornness to get back to where I want to be. And I've said this on a few different occasions, like people will hear stubbornness and there's kind of this immediate negative reaction mm-hmm. to it.
Yeah.
Stubbornness in its most elevated form is persistence, and persistence is the key to success in so many things in life.
Thank you for saying that. Can you describe or go into, and maybe there's not a difference between these two, but difference between stubbornness and discipline?
Sure, sure. Stubbornness in general, uh-huh. it gets a negative connotation because you end up in a situation where it's like the Titanic. The iceberg's coming. Mm-hmm. But we're not changing course. Okay, right. That's stubbornness, right? Mm-hmm. We're driving off the edge of the cliff, and we could have stopped, but we didn't want to. That's mm-hmm. stubbornness. There is a negative outcome potentially to holding to this course when you could have changed course. Mm-hmm. And so discipline and holding yourself towards a task acknowledges that, as the old military saying goes, no plan survives contact with the enemy. And as I have laid out an initial plan, I know that plan will change, but I have the discipline, the persistence to stick to that plan and the adjustments that I know are going to be necessary. So I think that's why stubbornness gets a bad name.
Right.
Because it's typically associated with somebody who refuses to accept the fact that there's going to be some adjustments needed, but doesn't have the discipline and persistence to stick to the goal, but adjust the plan.
Got it. Awesome. Thank you for defining both of those, because I've been told in my life, like, you're very stubborn, and like, again, that negative aspect has come into or aligned with that. So
potentially we hear that when we don't take someone else's opinion of what we should be doing. My parents, which, you know, love my parents, but I had asked their advice at a certain point, and they said, I don't know why you ask for our opinion. You never do what we advise. Mm-hmm. And my response was, that doesn't mean I don't want the info. I want to be able to put these opinions and pieces of the puzzle together and make my own choice. It may not be the choice that you want for me. Mm. That's usually when somebody says you're stubborn, when you're not doing what they want you to do. Mm. So kind of, you know, looking at that, not so much, we as human beings have we take everything personally, and we're usually just a mirror for the person that we're interacting with, and that kind of, well, you're just stubborn, can, not always, mm-hmm. but can translate into, well, you're just not doing what I think you should be doing.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm going to shift gears just a little bit. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit more about how kettlebell training has always allowed you to get back to your strength after numerous of surgeries and injuries. Mm-hmm. The listeners know this from the very first episode of how training has allowed me to really face a lot of the trauma that has happened in my life. And I think that's why I've been drawn or had this like longing of connection with the grad workouts that are held in level one now, I guess level two. And when we talked in Denver, I mentioned how I think it was really like a lot of the fast and loose that we do within our training, because as I was facing some of my trauma with my own life, and as I got more heavily involved with training other clients with kettlebells and teaching them the fast and loose stuff, they started opening up to me as well with some of their trauma that they've done or lived through, like with domestic violence, mm-hmm. sexual abuse, like some heavy stuff that their body was holding on to. What do you have to say about the type of training that allows our body to release some of this tension from trauma, and also the importance of working out in a community like that that allows to be seen to shake out some of that tension?
So I don't know if you've ever read the book Gates of Fire by Stephen Pressfield. Mm-mm. And Gates of Fire by Stephen Pressfield is about the Battle of Thermopylae. It is the 300, the Spartan 300 that was turned into the movie, you know, 300 by Frank Miller in the graphic novel. Well, there's a Stephen Pressfield's writes several different things. He I think excels in historical narratives, and so this is the Battle of Thermopylae. And so the Spartan culture was one of warfare, and they were the most feared army on the planet of their day. And so they were citizen soldiers who were, they grew up being soldiers, mm-hmm. being ready to go to war and die and do the things that are necessary in warfare. And so what they would do is they wore these wooden bracelets, and before a battle, they would take half of the bracelet and put it in a bucket. And at the end of the battle, they would go collect the other half of the bracelet. This was one of the ways they knew who survived and who didn't within a particular battle.
Okay.
And around that time frame where they're putting they're going to get the other half of their bracelet, and they would, as not as a group, but as a dispersed group, they would actually sit and shake and have this release. Regardless of how well trained you are, as the old saying goes, courage is not the absence of fear, it is persisting in the presence of fear. And so they would sit and they would shake. They would have this release. There would be soldiers that were consoling each other as they were both shaking and having this release of all of this fear and adrenaline and this horrible things that they had just done and mm-hmm. seen out on this battlefield. And no one looked down on any other soldier or Spartan who was doing this. Mm-hmm. It wasn't you're shaking, you're out. It was you're shaking and releasing this, and this is normal. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they would have this release, this cathartic sort of thing. And then they would go on to the next thing. And again, nobody looked down on anybody. It wasn't negative. It was normal. It was expected. It was just part of being a soldier within this society. We have glamorized, and I'll speak somewhat more specifically towards the soldier end of things. And mm-hmm. again, understanding we're all fighting our own battles and we are right. all our own soldiers. Mm-hmm. We have glamorized this warrior picture that we have from Hollywood mm-hmm. of the invincible person that takes on all of these horrible things and never shows up. They do all of these things, they survive all of these things, and they're just like, okay, let's go to the next. So we have this picture of if we shake, if we release emotion, that we are less than, that we are somehow not able to handle what's going on. And instead of accepting this release, and shaking is an interesting thing, because there are systems within Tai Chi Qigong that are based on shaking, on mm-hmm. vibration work and shaking. And if you've ever seen an animal that runs across the street, say yeah. a dog runs across the street and almost mm-hmm. gets hit, mm-hmm. what's it do once it gets to the other side? It shakes.
Yeah.
And you can see animals do this all the time. They will suffer a surprise of some sort, and they'll have this reaction, this stress reaction. And then afterwards, what do? They shake it off. Mm-hmm. And so there's this built-in, within the animal kingdom, there's this built-in release of adrenaline, fear, trauma. Mm-hmm. And we shut ourselves off from that. And so the fast and loose drills, the relaxation drills, the breathing drills, all of these things can have a function within this release of stress, trauma, et cetera. And our trauma and stress these days can be these things that we suffer through silent. There's financial stress. Mm-hmm. Financial stress is a huge one. There's relationship stress that we don't share with everyone. There's family stress. There's obviously work stress fits in there as well. So there's these variety of things that nowadays we're not going to war. We're not fighting for our survival from a typically from a battle standpoint, mm-hmm. or you know, having to hunt and gather our food for 8 to 10 hours a day, and having an unsuccessful hunt and knowing we're going to go hungry until we do finally find or get some food. But yet we have these incredibly stressful lives that we put the happy picture on Instagram, and then we go back home and we're not happy at all. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that we're supposed to be these unfeeling or perfect images of ourselves, and we can't have these releases from this stress, trauma, whatever may be going on. I think if you look back at one of the definitive warrior cultures of the world, and the fact that they accepted this shaking, this release of emotion and trauma as a standard to which was normal, I think we'd probably be better off.
Do you think Strong First has a certain role that goes into this? I know like the certifications are there to become a better coach, but this, I guess, is more on the healing aspect versus a coaching aspect and a certification aspect. Do you think Strong First will, there's an opportunity for that within the realm, since this is like an organization that does teach this type of training to the T on this?
And I'll speak as a we for Strong First. Strength has a greater purpose. Mm-hmm. I think that within that is encapsulated many different aspects. And while it's Strong First assumes that you're healthy. And there's an aspect to getting healthy that you need to be well with yourself. And in the accomplishment of strength, this pursuit of strength, I think there's many things that come together. Without really having to be said, you know, to your point earlier about, avoiding the body conversations and things like that. I think there's things that that are built in the pursuit of strength that are wide ranging. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you. That's it for, those are my questions.
Well, it's great. It's a different aspect of what we do that I think I talk to people all the time at workshops, and I use this as an example at a lot of the FMS workshops I teach, because there's times in someone's training where you have to ask them to stop doing something. Mm-hmm. I need you to not press overhead for a little while. I need you to not run for a little while, not swim for a little while, whatever the case may be. If that person is getting their identity via that activity and you ask them to stop doing it, you are challenging their very identity.
Their core.
And so why won't the runner listen to you? Mm-hmm. Why won't the client stop pressing? Like that's, you've tapped into something that's very much how they're identifying themselves. And again, having that honest but open situation where you can have those conversations. Mm-hmm. And very few of these conversations are ever, you need to stop doing this. Mm-hmm. The conversation is, need you to take a break.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Too much of a good thing is still too much.
Yeah. And I think that's, maybe this is my stubbornness coming into play, but when I first met you, you advised me just to focus on my career as a fitness industry or being a coach and a trainer versus really focusing on water skiing. And I was like, no. But again, that was my identity. And it went down into a really deep core of why I skied. And for listeners, if you haven't listened into my first episode, the 00, you'll learn more about my story of why water skiing was such a big identity for me. And it's been, it's interesting because I'm flirting with the idea of getting back to the sport just to ski, not to compete. But I think it's finally to the place where I'm like, this doesn't own me anymore. The sport doesn't own me and I can just enjoy it. And so there's a shift, I think, and a transformation of still being able to participate in some of those activities, but not having those activities own you and own your body. Do you have anything to say on that?
Yes.
Okay, great.
something that we take on, whether it's training, reading, whatever, something that we take on that we are going to spend time doing, it should enhance ourselves. It should, dare I say, be fun. And when something stops being fun, and I don't mean that everything should be, you know, like I said, kind of the champagne and roses sort of mindset where, you know, there's no struggle, there's no, it's all just, it's all fun. But you should have an enjoyment out of it. And from a holistic standpoint, not from a, well, people are going to really like this. It's something that you've done for yourself. It's something that you do for your betterment, and have fun. Like I actually enjoy training. I enjoy swinging a bell. I enjoy, what I do. I enjoy teaching, but travel is not fun anymore. So there's another struggle or another challenge to that aspect. So I think that, you know, the idea that, when you maybe first got involved in water skiing, God, it was just fun to get pulled down the lake and to ski. There was this freedom, this enjoyment of doing it. That was, that probably, someone who saw you doing that was like, I want to see that look every day for the rest of my life. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to make that happen. Right. And then pretty soon it became a job and it became something you were doing. And this goes into, I mean, that could be a triathlete, a track athlete, a baseball athlete, a football, you know, what, it doesn't matter. The activity doesn't matter. Dancer, it doesn't matter. But it went from joy to work. And that can be a problem unless it's actually going to be your job.
Well, my question goes to like professional athletes, like it is their job.
Right.
And I guess my question is like, do you think they still have fun with it within their job?
Yes and no.
Okay.
There's certainly a dichotomy there where they understand that this is their job. And now in the best of situations, you're realizing that your job is to play a game and to play a sport, or to have this kind of competitive nature to your life that is, hopefully very positive. In the worst situations, it's truly become the thing that you're still doing, because it's, just what you do and, you're surviving and not thriving, from what you're doing. But in a good situation, yes, it's your job, but you're having fun.
Right.
Yeah. The old saying that, find something you love to do, you'll never work a day in your life, while totally not true. While totally not true, it is a good idea. It's a good thought to have, but even the thing that you love to do most, it is work. There's hours to be put in. There's things to be accomplished. There's Dr. Phil in once in talking about relationships, is you have to be ready for the transition from the champagne and roses aspect of a relationship to the beer and pizza aspects of a relationship. You know, you're going to transition from this honeymoon phase to this day-to-day phase. And as much as you love, as much as I love what I do, I'd say about 70% of the time, 60% of the time, I think I'm really good at what I do. Mm-hmm. And then 30 or 40% of the time, I think, why would anyone listen to me? So there's work.
Yeah. This leads to the last question. As with training, there can be a big burnout and the turnover rate is huge.
Huge.
So my question is for the trainers. And then my question is also for those who just exercise. You can also get burnt out from exercising. What advice do you have for the trainer to stay in this career and avoid burnout? And for those who love training, you know, love their job, whatever it may be, what advice do you have for them to avoid burnout within their own health practice of exercise?
So for the fitness professional, you have to, I think a couple of the things we've already talked about it are pretty effective, not mm-hmm. holding people to your expectations, but establishing a work-life balance and something I still struggle with. I am a workaholic. I will put in the hours without a doubt. And work-life balance is something that's very, very challenging. And a lot of trainers struggle with work-life balance because they don't appreciate the financial aspects of what we do, of being a subcontractor. Mm-hmm. Now, the industry is changing. The industry is changing more to the standpoint of being an employee at a facility versus being a subcontractor to a facility. So that helps. There's somebody taking the taxes out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just ballpark, if you're a trainer that makes $100 an hour as a subcontractor, you don't make $100 an hour. Yeah. You're going to take 30% of that and set aside for taxes. You're down to 70. Mm-hmm. You're going to take another percentage of that, and that's your rent or your mortgage. And another percent is the car. Another percent is the phone. Another percent is the health insurance. Another percent is retirement. Another percent is life insurance. So that if anything happens to you, your family is taken care of. There's, by the time you get to the end of the day, you have $5 left to buy supplements, which you thought were really important at the beginning of that $100, right? So I think there's an aspect of looking at this and treating it as a profession and running the numbers and being sure that you're, because you know, like financial stress is financial and relationship stress are two of the worst forms of stress, and they can be backbreaking. And so, making sure that you don't fall down those rabbit holes, I think, would help a lot of trainers succeed and not suffer from the burnout standpoint. Because there's definitely that. From the general exerciser standpoint, find something that's fun. Like, people make fun of Zumba. Guess what people love to do? They love to be in the same room dancing and having fun.
Yeah.
If you love Zumba, Zumba yourself as much as you would like. Have a strength practice that supports the Zumba.
Yeah.
But, you know, I enjoy hiking. I like getting out and going for a hike. And that's something I do to decompress and just spend a little time for me and my wife. And I think that's something that's really important. So your fitness should take you somewhere that you want to be, if that makes sense. You know, a lot of traditional training modalities come from military style training, even gymnastics. Physical therapy is an outcome of the Swedish gymnastics schools of school of thought of P.H. Ling, which gave us Swedish massage and became physical therapy and this more rehabilitative nature. But a lot of military training led to these gymnastic style trainings that, you know, we were training a martial component, your ability to respond appropriately to aggression. Well, fitness has become our martial art.
Yeah.
And that's, on the one hand, due to the nature of our modern lives, I mean, that's a, I guess I would say a fairly natural outcome that as physical beings, we need to be physical and, and to do these things. But when training fitness has become our martial art, instead of fitness becoming something that we do to get better at something else or to be able to enjoy something else, I think we've kind of crossed our wires just a little bit. And so let your fitness take you someplace, whether it's hiking or water skiing or whatever, bird watching. I don't care where your fitness takes you, but have a strength practice, have a practice that takes you someplace and gives you some enjoyment.
Yeah, awesome. Well, we're going to be wrapping it up. Is there anything else that you would like to share with the listener?
No, I just think it's nice to be able to have a conversation that's not about the sets and reps, and to kind of talk about this aspect. And it, you know, it's the message that Strong First has, the mission to pursue, promote, and practice strength, because we believe strength has a greater purpose, is a far-ranging message. It's not an isolated message to deadlifting or squatting. It's a this aspect of respect and strength that should have a real positive impact in people's lives.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the show. I know the listeners, a lot of people have been asking me, like, when do you interview Brent Jones? So they're eager to hear what you have to say. So I'm really excited to share this with everyone. Strong Ones, thank you. Strong Ones, thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you share the love with the family and friends and give it the 5 stars and leave a comment below. Other than that, we will be peacing out until next week. Hey, Strong Ones, I have some really exciting news for you guys. I am hosting the Women of Iron Strength Retreat. This is for women who love lifting heavy, who love kettlebells, and also want to learn and progress their movement skills with the pistol squat, the pull-up, and the kettlebell press. I will be hosting this with Ann Cass Stevens down at her gym, Team Muscle Bus, in Salt Lake City, June 22nd and 23rd. So we'll be mainly focusing on those three movements, really diving into those and allowing you, giving you the skills and the tips for you can progress very quickly. We will also be diving in a little bit with the Strong First Level 1 and Level 2 movement and skills with those. This is not a Strong First event. It is just a retreat hosted by 2 Strong First instructors who are passionate about these three lifts, who want to empower women to feel comfortable and confident to be able to do a pistol squat, a pull-up, and a press. This retreat is not just getting PRs in those three lifts, but it's also getting PRs in life. PRs with new friendships, a new mental toughness, and a new level of emotional stamina as well. So come join us, me and Ann Cass Stevens, down at her gym, Team Muscle Bus, Salt Lake City area, June 22nd to 23rd. If you have questions about this event, let's connect. I'm on Instagram at Anna_Willard_. Hit me up in the DMs. You can find me on Facebook. Again, Anna Willard. Send me a private message. Or if you like the traditional way of connecting through email, my email is coachwillard10@gmail.com. If you have questions about this event, please let me know. Other than that, more information is down in the show notes. Again, this is an event for women, hosted by women, to get some PRs in lifting and some PRs in life. Other than that, Strong Ones, you guys have a wonderful week and blessings on your journey.